Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Chris Patterson, also in Cape Town, along with me. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing good. And you?
I'm all right. And we also have Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you?
Hi, Nick. Hi, Chris. Doing well, thank you. Thanks for having me back on. I look forward to seeing how you handle having two Chrises on at the same time, Nick.
Well, I'll figure out a way. Once again, apologies for any echoiness in my sound. I'm still kind of setting up everything here on my side, having moved house recently. Right, let's get into the news story of today. And this is quite a dramatic one, although it's not the first time we've heard of this story. And that is that the city of Joburg is once again being threatened to have its electricity supply cut off by Eskom for not paying its bills. This came up a few months ago when Joburg and Eskom, it turned out, were in a dispute over how much money Joburg owes to Eskom. Apparently, Joburg has not been paying its bills. Part of the reason for that seems to be that Joburg is in a pretty bad financial situation right now, not able to recover a lot of costs, seeing a huge reduction in the amount of money it's getting in from electricity sales, and just generally being in a kind of badly run state. The city of Joburg, for its part, says that Eskom is overbilling it and so has refused to pay the amount that Eskom says that Joburg owes. Well, a notice was issued on Friday recently, which said that it was from Eskom saying that the city of Johannesburg and or City Power, which is, of course, a part of the city of Joburg, owes Eskom 4.9 billion rand. Excluding the current account for a further 1.4 billion rand due and payable at the end of November 2024, despite all avenues that Eskom has explored and efforts to accommodate the city of Johannesburg, the matter has reached a point where Eskom can simply no longer afford to accommodate the city of Joburg without further financial strain and harming its own business. In terms of the Constitution of Intergovernmental Relations framework, the city of Johannesburg is supposed to cooperate and assist Eskom with fulfilling its mandate of assuring South Africans have access to affordable electricity. City of Joburg has breached these obligations by not paying Eskom for the bulk electricity it supplies, making it impossible for Eskom to fulfill its mandate. I believe Joburg is the biggest customer of Eskom, and so if Joburg doesn't pay, Eskom's financials, which have only relatively recently begun to see some improvement, are going to be set back in quite a big way. So it's imperative that Joburg does, in fact, pay its bills. Joburg has hit back saying, the city of Johannesburg has given Eskom, what it says, is 5 days to retract its public notice and warned residents of its intention to battle against the attempt to cut off electricity supply. They say that while this thing is under legal dispute, they can't cut the supply to the city. They say that it was improper for Eskom to issue this notice publicly, that this should have been done privately, and that this is all negotiating in bad faith on Eskom's part. They're basically accusing Eskom of trying to, you know, bully the city of Joburg into complying in the state, in public opinion, in the realm of public opinion. I would also like to remind the city of Joburg that very often when its customers get a bill that they believe is incorrect, the city of Joburg tells them to pay first and dispute later. So it's kind of funny to see the Joburg having to deal with the sort of exactly the same problem that it deals with. But anyway, and of course, the consequences of Joburg having its power supply either reduced or cut off by Eskom would be disastrous. It's the city's most important economic hub. It is the beating heart of South Africa in so many ways. It is also our biggest city, of course. Millions and millions of people's lives will be disrupted, and the economy will take a huge hit, probably forcing the national government to bail out the city of Joburg or pay the dispute, which would, of course, be very bad for the fiscus. Chris Hutton, let me start with you. What do you make of this? I mean, it's kind of shocking that it got to this point. If my kind of gut feeling here is, does it really matter who's at fault here? This is so important that, you know, they should sort it out quickly rather than disputing every legal fact. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I suppose in the spirit of GNU-ness and taking responsibility for the current situation in which the country the state in which the country finds itself, low growth, high unemployment, rising inequality, taking ownership of the situation, taking control of what falls under one's purview, whether that's Eskom or whether the city of Joburg / city power, and finding the best possible route forward to ensure the provision of electricity to ratepayers continues. If you just look at the not just one golden egg, but the many golden eggs that the city of Joburg management would have been handed. If you've got a growing population, you should have higher revenue collection, you've got more people engaged in economic activity, which means it's easier for businesses to be formed, all things being equal, than in a province or a metro where there are fewer people. It's just more human capital available to try and invest, to solve problems, to engage and trade with each other, all that sort of stuff. So you're given this on a silver platter. And then over time, through the wrong management decisions, through vested interests in terms of the politics, through the wrong ideological choices, legislative and policy choices, over time, you start to chip away at your available infrastructure, at those citizens and businesses that had paid you rates in the past. And you know, because of push factors, moved maybe to other provinces or were forced to close down. They just didn't have the capacity maybe to buy diesel for generators when load shedding was, you know, in place for the last, 15 years, if not longer. So all of these things really come together. In terms of the way forward, I guess, you know, from an incentive point of view, a self-interest point of view, you've got the next local government elections. It should be held in 2026. So those metros, those political parties that get involved and solve these problems in the best way could benefit from that. On the other hand, because parties are so focused on those elections, they could lose sight of the day-to-day, very difficult work of solving sometimes seemingly intractable problems, and just focus on the optics of saying we're creating jobs, 10 million jobs through this way or whatever. Take your pick. I mean, the biggest thing that really, I guess, sticks in my craw is that in the statement that you mentioned from City of Joburg, you know, the whole Eskom's approach is pay now and resolve disputes later in its dealings with the City of Joburg can no longer go unchallenged. And then City of Joburg does that to residents. You undermine any particular trust that citizens in your metro had with you, if that was there still remaining in any case. So you're not going to get buy-in from citizens and businesses that you need to help with resolving this, if at all possible. It's just, yeah, City of Joburg, City Power not doing themselves any favors.
So Chris Patterson, you know, this really seems kind of like, to me, the capstone of what has been a really unsuccessful period of governance in the city of Johannesburg. Ever since the 2021 elections, there's been this kind of first instability where the DA controlled the city for a little bit, and then they got forced out, then they came back, and their coalitions were very unstable. And then eventually the sort of ANC-EFF coalition created this sort of agreement between the two that they would place Al Jamaha in charge of the city's mayorship so that they could kind of divide the portfolios underneath that between themselves. And it just has been a disaster for the city. I mean, there are many reasons that I have moved from Joburg, but one of them was that since, I believe, about 2020, Joburg's governance has just gone downhill. And I do wonder what the political consequences of this will be. You know, the ANC in Joburg in 2021 got about 33% of the vote. The EFF got about 10. Action SA, I guess, which is technically a supply and confidence agreement with the ANC and EFF, there got about 16%. I wonder what the consequences are going to be. I don't know. What do you make of this mess? I mean, how did we get to this position?
Well, since 2021, we've seen voter turnout in Johannesburg and other Gauteng metros drop like a stone in a bucket of water, effectively. So people are just opting out of the voting process. And the city manager recently blamed the coalitions and the political instability on the city's financial position. So unless people go out and vote, you see, for example, I was recently in Johannesburg, the roads are overgrown, there's no paint on the road, there's so much wrong in that city, but the people, they simply opt out because they see the political parties fighting with each other and not solving the problems. So unless they start voting or realizing that voting actually has an impact on the way services are delivered in the city, then nothing is going to change.
Yeah, no, I think it's very interesting to watch whether there's maybe an opportunity for some kind of new party to pop up. Although, that being said, we had a bunch of new parties recently, and I don't know if voters have been entirely impressed with them. It may be difficult for someone else new to enter the arena unless they have a lot of credibility backing them. Chris, any final thoughts on this one? I mean, I think it's clear that the problems here are all due to messy politics, patronage politics, the usual problems of corruption and cater deployment, which have ruined so many municipalities, all kind of accumulating together to create this straight-up crisis in our country's most important municipality.
I think it's important to add that the choices that have led to the situation are not forced on city officials or in political parties in the city of Joburg. It's their own choices, their predecessors, those who are now in place. It's not someone holding a gun to their head. If that is the case, of course, then there's the various opportunities for dealing with allegations around corruption and all that sort of thing. So I'm not saying it's easy to solve those problems. I'm just the buck has to stop somewhere. And those people are in that position of being servants, public servants, to be paid taxes and rates. And they have the responsibility to try and solve these issues. Just, it's so important to get Joburg and Gauteng right. If you consider that Gauteng is responsible for around 25% of South Africa's total population, so it's responsible for 25% of the total. And then if you look at growth now into 2026, there's an expectation, and in terms of analysis we did in a recent macro review, around 1.4 million people are expected to come to the province between 2021 and 2026. I mean, compared to other provinces, there's just so much scope for potential, for growth, for job creation, getting the basics right. It's not magic bullets, silver bullets. It's unfortunately very difficult governance and policy work. So let's see if that realization comes about or not.
Exactly. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is kind of one of the ongoing things in the background, which are as a result of the May elections, which is that the country's politics may be about to shift in some very fundamental ways. This is based off of an opinion piece written by Natasha Marion in Business Live, which talks about the possibility of a realignment with the ANC moving away from its tripartite alliance partners, those being COSATU and the South African Communist Party. So ever since the formation of the Government of National Unity and the inclusion of the DA, COSATU and the SACP have been fairly unhappy campers. COSATU has taken a little bit more of a moderate line. It's clear that the different unions within COSATU seem to have slightly different views as to the GNU. But the largest of these, NAHAWU, has decided that it is very strongly against the Government of National Unity, as well as the police union POPCRU, which has come out against the GNU. POPCRU, in fact, went as far as to describe the GNU as, quote, a disaster for black people. The SACP has also attacked the Government of National Unity very aggressively, saying that it was the ANC weakening working class power and giving into neoliberal tendencies. It's not clear from an objective standpoint whether that's actually true yet. I mean, you know, the ANC has not even decided whether it's going to budge on something like the Bella Bill, so I hardly see the great neoliberal tide that the SACP seems to see. But maybe they know something I don't. But anyway, the SACP is flirting again, although they do this pretty much every election, with the idea of maybe running independently from the ANC in the elections. But, you know, maybe it will happen for real this time, in which case I encourage them to do so because I reckon they won't get anywhere particularly quickly. Chris Patterson, what are your thoughts? I mean, do you actually think the tripartite alliance may break up? You know, the SACP and COSATU in many ways are less powerful than they've ever been on a sort of objective standpoint. Like, I'm not talking about within the ANC, I'm talking about within the country. You know, there's no clear indication the SACP has real grassroots support anywhere. And COSATU has been fracturing and it's divided and it seems to be sort of shrinking just generally. Will you think the ANC and its allies finally have the breakup that has been talked about for a long time?
I'm not really sure at the moment. But in 2001, I remember the SACP and COSATU and the ANC had a falling out over the growth economic and the gear policy, and that sort of introduced the tensions into it. And I think the DA's inclusion in the GNU is sort of is making the SACP sort of panic a little bit, and it's trying to throw its toys out of the cot. But I seriously wonder how much toys is still in that cot to throw out, because I think things will just go silent. They'll get used to it. They have to get used to it if this government's going to last.
Yeah, no, this is exactly the problem, is that they'll say, well, we'll pull out of the alliance, at which point the ANC might say, okay, well, that just means more patronage for us. We don't have to accommodate you anymore. it's like threatening to shoot yourself to get your way. It's not really an incredible threat. You know, you can't really rob a bank with that. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I think what's very interesting, of course, is that I'm glad you mentioned gear, Chris, is that you know, it was during the era of the gear policy that South Africa saw its greatest advancements in the democratic era. We had job growth, we had economic growth on a scale that we haven't seen since. We saw reduction in crime. Basically, on every social indicator, South Africa went forward. So it seems, as to put it fairly bluntly, whenever the SACP and COSATU are unhappy, it generally seems to me that the country may in fact be going in the right direction. Chris Hutton, maybe that's a bit simplistic, but what do you make of this?
Yes, when you're outside the GNU, at least at this point in time, when you're not close to the fire, life becomes quite a bit more difficult to deal with. So despite one's prognostications, your outrage that you say you're experiencing, all of that sort of thing, if you're not involved and in some way involved in the decision-making, policy-making, legislative-making, legislation-making process, Let's taking them at their word, if you're that concerned about the GNU and its neoliberalism 2.0, are you not abdicating your responsibility to the working class and to poor South Africans by not being involved, by not trying to influence things in the corridors of power? Are you just going to sit outside and sort of throw stones and look at your fellow South Africans, you know, become poorer and poorer over time? Or what's the where's your moral sort of culpability and taking of responsibility? This is the second point I want to mention, and this was highlighted by Institute fellow Gabriel Krauser in a recent piece in News 24. He highlighted that in 2007, the unemployment rate amongst Black South Africans was 23%. On the latest count, it is at 37.6%. And on the expanded definition, Black unemployment has risen to 47%. So, you know, if we're talking about policies, their consequences, the quote-unquote plight of Black people, as though all Black people are the same, all of that sort of identity politics aside, the current policies we have and have had in place since at least 2007, 2008 are not benefiting those ostensibly supposed to benefit from them. So is it not time for a rethink if indeed amongst some of these unions their concern is the plight, again, of quote-unquote Black people?
Right. This is exactly what infuriates me so much about the SACP and COSATU. They have had their way in policy for decades. Since the beginning of the Zuma era, but also even going back to the labor laws passed in the mid-90s, COSATU and the SACP have had a huge impact on the country's fortunes and policy framework. And what's happened? Well, particularly since they gained more power with the rise to power of Jacob Zuma in 2008 and the end of gear, the country has suffered. It has stagnated. It has gone backwards. Unemployment has risen. Life for all South Africans, but also for Black South Africans, has gotten worse in so many respects. And yet they sort of pretend as though, you know, these neoliberal tendencies of the ANC have been creeping in for ages. It's like, no, they haven't. What, just because they haven't nationalized every industry? You guys have been in the driving seat for a really long time. The SACP until 5 minutes ago was described as, you know, the intellectual heart of the ANC. And now they're sort of pretending as though they had nothing to do with the mess that's engulfing the country. Chris Patterson, any final thoughts?
just one. Socialists get more greedy as time goes on.
Yeah, no, it seems so.
Nick, if I can make a last point, sorry.
Go ahead, Chris.
Very conveniently. Just the sort of contentions around austerity and neoliberalism and a shrinking state. I'll accept that sometimes public sector wage increases don't match inflation. So in some ways, that's a reduction. But also, as of the latest medium-term budget, for every rand that the government collects, it has to spend 22 cents to repay its debt. That's on non-useful spending. If you're assuming the state spends well, spends accurately, uses all the money well, 22 cents of every rand goes to pay off the state's debts. So that debt burden has been increasing. You've got a bigger government over time, but the efficiency thereof has declined, which doesn't benefit the people, again, that the SACP and COSATU and others supposedly care about and talk for. So, yeah, there's the moral arguments aside of having a state that wants to do everything for all the people, on the economics, the policies aren't working. So rather save the faux outrage and take responsibility and start to like fix actually what the responsibility that you have as well.
No, exactly. I mean, if this is austerity, I would like to see what a spending blowout looks like. All right. Let's go again, once again, over the border of SA to Mozambique, where the trouble is only continuing. So we talked about this briefly on the show yesterday, me and John, just discussing very briefly the trouble there that forced the closure of the border between South Africa and Mozambique. And this is all because Mozambique's recent elections saw the ruling party, Frelimo, which has been the governing party since independence, be awarded 71% of the vote, with the main opposition candidate getting 20% of the vote. However, the opposition heavily disputes this, and observers from outside the country, from the EU, for example, have said that there was definitely some irregularities in the voting. Whether it was enough to have actually displaced Frelimo, I don't think is really necessarily important. Mozambique is not a very free country. Human rights are regularly abused by the police and army there. And the country has been teetering on the edge for a while. It's had periods of relative stability after its civil war ended in the 90s. It's had periods of regression. It had an economic crisis not too long ago because the finance minister stole a whole bunch of money that had been given by the IMF to bail out the country. And it looks like Mozambican citizens have had enough. There has been significant protests and riots across the country, which started in Maputo, the capital, but appear to be spreading across the rest of the country. These are quite serious. The South African High Commissioner to Mozambique, Simpiwe Nyanda, has said that Maputo is almost under siege at this point. Nyanda said, it is protest all over Mozambique, throughout the country, but the main manifestation that we experience here is in Maputo. Basically, Maputo is almost under siege. That the airport has been blocked off by protesters, and there are soldiers everywhere trying to contain the protests. At least 15 people have died, and over 100 have been injured so far in these clashes between police, army, and protesters. Now, the South African embassy staff say that they are safe for the moment. They are in an enclave in Maputo that is protected. But it clearly seems as though the government is having a bit of a difficult time. And so far, as far as I can tell, the Mozambican government's response to everything has just been kind of to try and crush everything with an iron fist rather than actually sort of, you know, talking to the protesters. This is obviously not great for South Africa as well. The potential for chaos in Mozambique, which has already suffered from chaos in the north of the country because there's an ISIS-backed insurgency there, is quite significant. This could result in more illegal immigration into South Africa from Mozambique. It could result in us being unable to use Maputo's port to sell our goods, which we've had to do because Durban port is not in great shape at the moment. This may have all sorts of other consequences, including the spreading of disorder into Zimbabwe. There's apparently going to be a meeting of the South African development community from the 16th to the 20th of November to call for dialogue, which is a fairly anemic response as far as I'm concerned. Chris, you're a foreign minister. What would you do from a South African perspective to deal with this crisis in Mozambique?
Well, that's a very easy question, so I'm glad you asked Chris P. there.
Don't dodge.
Okay, fair enough. Look, again, in the context of a GNU and South Africa, the government saying that it's practicing neutrality and non-alignment in all sorts of global matters and wants to be a bridge between parties in conflict. If you're going to wait to participate in this particular summit or conference until, the 16th, and you haven't yet set up some sort of red line or a few red lines for the current government in Mozambique, and if they step over those lines, you see them as illegitimate when it comes to things like cracking down on protests in a violent manner. Then all of your talk about respecting democracy, the rule of law, free and fair elections, you undermine yourself in your own backyard. And then on the global stage, when you say you want to help resolve the conflict between Ukraine and Russia or that going on in Palestine and Gaza, you start to ask serious questions about the believability of the values and things that you talk about. Wanting to be influential in geopolitics and in diplomatic channels, I'm not saying that there isn't an opportunity for quote-unquote backroom negotiations and quiet diplomacy, but you need to back that up. If you say one thing, but you can't actually practice that either in the sort of public eye or behind the scenes to the warring parties, then no one's going to take you on board in any case. And then if you do engage in those processes, you're just legitimizing violence. You're giving your sanction to violent parties by not using the weight that you do still somewhat have. And South Africa does have that, especially on the African continent. Of course, very prominent in the African Union. But over time, your legitimacy and your ability to actually influence things on the ground becomes watered down if you don't use these opportunities. So, I mean, at the end of the day, the most important thing here is people, Mozambicans losing their lives, their democratic choice not being respected. So I don't want to lose sight of that. But from the South African, broad government perspective, you say you want to refresh and you want to do things differently in foreign policy and geopolitics. No better place than to start that than in your own backyard.
No, exactly right. If we want South Africa to have prosperous trading partners, if we want South Africa to not have to deal with big flows of illegal immigrants, if we want South Africa to have a stable region that doesn't cause problems for us, we need to have democratic neighbors that function properly, that respect human rights, that respect the rule of law, that respect property rights, all these other things. And, the approach from the ANC since it came to power has been essentially to just kind of follow what many in the African Union usually do, which is kind of whenever there's a coup or whenever there's a crackdown on protests or whenever there's a stolen election, it's usually just to sort of cover your eyes and then say something about dialogue. And then maybe in an extreme case, like in Zimbabwe, you hammer out a deal which completely crushes the democratic opposition and just sort of pays them off with government positions temporarily, which, South Africa's dealings in Zimbabwe, I think, in many ways are the kind of original sin in the region. They kept ZANU-PF perpetually in power, and the consequences have been severe. Zimbabwe remains in a pretty much collapsed state, unable to function properly at all, and South Africa has had to bear some of the burden of that. And then the ANC sort of turns around and says, oh, all these illegal foreigners are causing unemployment. Well, firstly, they're not. Your policies are doing that. And secondly, maybe they wouldn't all be coming here if you didn't encourage the collapse of their country by supporting their dictatorial, corrupt, and incompetent regime. Chris Patterson, do you agree with me? What do you make of this?
I do. The ANC has always taken the side of what they call their fraternal liberation movement partners. So automatically the electorate in those countries who vote for the opposition is at a disadvantage. So unless the government takes a stand, then things are going to just stay the same. Those Mozambicans are going to come across the border running away from their problems. They're going to come set up businesses here. They'll do all sorts of things. But unless they... It's just if they don't solve the problem, then nothing is going to change. I mean, you have to take a stand. Something has to change because things are just going to get worse.
No, exactly right. Chris Hutton, any final thoughts before we close up for today?
Now, just what you mentioned in the chat there on Botswana and elections happening there, and you've got the ruling party for the first time.
Botswana is a perfect counterexample of how things could be done.
Yeah. So the ruling party out of power for the first time in 58 years and opting to step aside and the peaceful handover of power. I think it's not a given, especially in, you know, more developed Western countries. This doesn't always happen, and don't take it for granted. I think it, for the government of national unity, but for the ANC specifically, still the biggest political party in the country. Of course, the drop in these elections notwithstanding, these changes, you know, can come for you at some point as well. It's, you know, countries, the movement of people, it's all interlinked, interconnected. South Africa has the benefit of being the gateway to Africa in many ways in terms of developed infrastructure, financial markets. But if you don't use the avenues available to you to influence things in a positive direction in neighboring countries, I'm not talking about like regime change and things like that, you know. But if you don't use your
critical statement is a good start, right?
Yes. If you don't use that and eventually the changes come to you, then what are you going to do then? I guess go to Dubai maybe or somewhere else. Yeah.
No, exactly. Anyway, I suspect the Frelimo government is going to have to learn what many poorly run countries learn eventually, which is that you either reform or you lose power. And, you know, you can delay it and you can delay it, but in the end, an unstable, ineffective regime will not survive. Okay, let us call it to a close there. It is Friday. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. I see there's some construction work starting outside my house now, so it's best that I go off quickly before there's lots of bashing and hammering sounds in the background. But anyway, I hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and we will see you next week. Cheers, everyone. Have a good one.